So I talked to the pilot of the real 206 that this is based on, and he saw the Southwest 737 coming. He wasn't worried. Clearly, the Southwest pilots weren't worried. In Portland, the tower saw this, and they weren't worried. And everyone was surprised when this Cessna ended up on its nose. And at the time, when I was talking to him, he was in discussions with the insurance company as to whether or not the plane was going to be totaled because there was so much damage to it. So how is a pilot supposed to know when they're in this intermediate zone, like whether this is something to, you know, wave the red flag or be like, look, it's just going to rock the airplane a little bit. It's not really a problem. What do you say, Bob?
Well, early on in my flying career, I was flying at airports where there were, you know, transport category aircraft flying. And we were taught, try to stay 500 to 700 feet away from the big airplanes. That was just a general rule of thumb. And of course, I just took it for what it was worth, never really understood why that was so, other than I knew that if you got too close, you got stunk out of your airplane by kerosene fumes. That's something that, you know, could happen if you've got the right set of circumstances. You're going to have trouble with these big airplanes. So stay far away. That's the best thing you could do. If you've got a large run-up area and you're going to be sitting there for a while, use the run-up area. Get far enough away so that you're not going to inhale kerosene fumes at a minimum and have any chance of any damage when the big guys passes by you.
This happens a lot more often than people realize. So I'm always sweeping through NTSB reports, and these things come up. And they don't have to be reported, so there are probably a lot more that happen that we don't hear about. And it's not just big airplanes. Our airplane was blown over by a King Air. This was about 3 years ago, blown up on its wing. One of the partners taxied by behind a King Air that was either running up or testing an engine or something, blew it up on the wing, damaged the wing. And Jeff, you should look for the link to a YouTube video where I think it was an Airbus, and I can't remember. It blew a hangar away. They taxied in front of it. They went to whatever power they went to, completely blew the hangar, lifted it and blew it out of the way, which gives hangar flying a whole new name. Had to go there.
Well, yeah, you said, you know, your airplane got blown over, Paul. Now, granted, that's a Cub, so if somebody sneezes hard on the ramp, you know, it's going to rock the wings. But
yeah, but you wouldn't think anything about a turboprop, right? At least I wouldn't necessarily. And the airplane was probably maybe 100 feet behind it.
So again, it goes back to that question. Like, if you don't think it's going to be a problem, you can't be so paranoid that whenever there's another airplane powered up on the ramp, you know, tell everybody to stop so you can get out of the way. How do we deal with this?
Well, again, you know, if I was a pilot in Bellingham and I knew that the control tower couldn't see that area of the run-up pad, and I'm in a Cessna, even if it's a 206, and I see an Airbus coming down, my senses are heightened. I know that the airplane is going to have some jet blast behind it. And to me, pilot in command means that I'm going to keep my airplane and my passengers and myself safe at all times. And what I would have done in that situation is not talk to the tower. I would have said, because clearly the Allegiant pilots can see me right out the windscreen, and I would have said, hey, Allegiant, this is the Cessna in the run-up pad. Can you guys hold short for a minute and let me get out of your way? And then I would have taken the middleman out of the scenario, so there's not such a rush of the, you know, hey, they're going to be here in 10 seconds. I would have talked right to the pilot and said, hey, you guys, stop. Let me get out of your way. I would have done a 270, got to the back of the corner as far back as I could have and stopped. Or as the Allegiant guys said, hey, do you guys mind if I get off before you? Because I'm ready to go and I don't want to get behind you. I would have tried to take control of the situation to make sure that that didn't happen.
Devil's advocate here, Michael, which frequency would you have used to talk with them directly? Because they're almost at the runway.
They should have been on the tower by then.
Hope, right? But maybe you had just finished your run up. You had maybe just switched. So 10 seconds, man, that's rough. Is there anybody who would have just pulled forward enough to be like, I'm going to stop this whole situation because I can't talk to anybody? No takers on that.
The more you think about this, Jeff, the 10 seconds is really the critical issue here, in that this got down to 10 seconds. You need to be looking around and watching what's going on around you. Now, even if this Allegiant was taxiing at maybe 15 knots, which he could very well have been doing, you could have easily have seen this situation develop in 30 or 40 seconds beforehand. So keep an eye on what's going on around you.
So, Bob, you were talking about positioning the controls on the ground, and, you know, that is an issue. This whole thing could have happened potentially where the pilot was face down on the run-up and felt the airplane begin to rock, looked up, and there was the back end of a jet spinning past.
And he grabbed the controls, maybe.
Hmm? Yeah.
And possibly grabbed hold of the yoke with the elevator in a down position.
I think we've talked about this before, Bob, that you've said that this has been a weak spot that you've seen just even on private pilot tests about people dealing with the, you know, wind position, sitting on the ground or taxiing around, something like that. Is that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The typical private pilot thinks compensating for the wind is strictly something you do on takeoff or landing, and doesn't consider it on the taxiway or relative to other aircraft in the area. So it really is necessary that you be aware of where the wind is coming from or where any potential wind from another aircraft is coming from, and hold your controls accordingly.
So I'm going to throw this down to the table of experts here. If you're taxiing, you know, at the speeds we all taxi at, and the wind's not howling, isn't your relative wind far greater than any wind that we teach the private pilots about, like pushing down when the wind's behind you, pulling back, you know, diving away and so forth, and maybe particularly to Paul, who drives around in a light tailwheel airplane all the time. What about with the winds behind you? Is that you cancel that out when you're taxiing or not? Because that seems to get taught a bunch of ways.
If it's a significant wind, I just use a simple memory aid, which is climb into it and dive away from it for winds that are significantly quartering either way.
Paul, do you do that even in your tailwheel when you have a wind coming from directly behind you in a tailwheel?
Even airplane? When you're taxiing?
Definitely when taxiing. I mean, when it's significant. I took the Cub out a couple months ago in 24 knot winds to see if I could do it. And the wind was down the runway, so I knew I could land it. That wouldn't be the problem. So I went out to see if I could land it in a 24-knot crosswind. I could not. But when I was taxiing, it was a handful. And when I got back to the hangar, got out of the airplane to open up the hangar doors, the wind spun it right around, spun it right into the wind. So anything above about 10 or 12 knots, I really pay attention to it, because when you get lazy, and this is true of any tail dragger, almost of any weight, next thing you know, you're in a ditch asking what happened here.
Yeah, I think flying a tailwheel airplane will help reinforce that. The other day I was flying a 180 and I had a pretty strong crosswind coming from the left. It wasn't that, I mean, it was like probably 10, 15 knots, something like that. But on the taxi out, I actually thought I might have had a dragging brake. It was pivoting so hard into that crosswind, and it really reinforced the impact that the wind has on like your vertical stabilizer and all that, even at relatively low speed. So it kind of helps reinforce some of those basic aerodynamics.
Do you do the same in the Navion?
Not as much. Yeah, not as much, and probably not appropriately. It's probably out of laziness. I should more. It's just it's not as noticeable.
Right. So you're not getting that constant reinforcement.
Yeah.
Nose wheel sort of, you know, stabilizes you and gets you lazy. And then you'll run into the situation where you're on a little bit of a slippery surface and you haven't been paying attention, and the nose wheel's not going to do it for you. The airplane's going to pivot on you. Particularly in the winter when there's snow banks along the side, it could be pretty tricky.
Yeah, I owned a Cessna 120, a little tailwheel airplane, for about 7 years, and I think it's kind of what Paul was alluding to. I found that the real limitation on flying in winds wasn't takeoff and even landing, it was taxiing. There were several times when I started to taxi out, and it was so challenging just to get to the runway that I aborted the flight and took it back to the hangar. It's very easy to get lazy in a heavier airplane like the Navion Richard flew or the Bonanzas and Barons I fly. I teach people to use the taxi control position inputs for the wind all of the time to condition them to always be doing that so that it's instinctive and natural to do that when they are taking off or landing with a crosswind. They don't have to think as much about it because it's become muscle memory to do it all of the time.
I guess the nature of my question was more when the winds are, you're taxiing, you've got a tailwind, you're taxiing at, you know, maybe say 8-10 knots and it's an 8 or 10 knot tailwind. Like, you've now, you know, which wind do you care about? You've kind of neutralized things out here. But maybe at that point, because it doesn't matter as much, then better to build the muscle memory for all situations.
As far as the relative wind, just stick your arm out the window. You know, you'll feel whether the primary wind is coming from the prop going backwards or from the, you know, from the external air going forwards. You know, it's a short little test there. But, you know, getting back to our scenario, it seems like the secret to happiness is having low expectations. And we should happiness in life, low expectations. And it's the same with our fellow pilots, because it's like, I have no expectation that this that the airline crew is going to be aware of where their jet blast is going and where my position relative to them is. So, to the people who are saying they're going to take action, I think that's wise because I have zero confidence that the crew, they're in a busy time. They're you know, checking their clearances. They're getting their avionics set. They're often in a hurry. They're behind schedule. I have no expectation that they are aware of my position or that they're about to blast me and could damage my airplane. So, that's going to be the basis of any future decision I make.
Yeah, their concern for you is pretty much limited to you're not in the way. As long as they can pass, they're going to pass.
And that would start really on your decision to go into the airport in the first place. And then once you did decide and you get on the ramp, then you have to be aware of what's going on around there. And I think the most hazardous ones are the one where there's only one or two operations. But that's the one that, in this situation, is probably like that. That's the one that bites you because, hey, you're not expecting it.
You know, and that may be sort of the best summation of this, Dave, that I'm not sure I could even top that. Because you've got a real point, right? If it's that pervasive awareness of a situation that you've got to sort of run the numbers, if you will, quickly in your mind. Like, is this something I need to be concerned about? Or is this something that I really shouldn't? And by having a low expectation of it working out well, right, that you say, look, if it's marginal, let me do something about this now when there's time to do something about it, rather than rushing to try and fix a situation that turned into something that got out of control. And not having to be panicked about it, but certainly taking proactive action, whether that's on the ground, whether that's coming in after a big airplane and there's wake turbulence or any of those other possibilities where somebody else's actions, if you project forward, even just 10 seconds, could have a serious impact on what's happening for you in your airplane.